For those of you who don't know me, my name's Mark Moore. I'm director of the Centre for Corporate and Commercial Law, or 3CL, as we call it here. And I'm delighted to welcome you to the inaugural first seminar of the 2016-17 academic year. This is the first seminar on our 3CL Trevor Smith Lunchtime Seminar Series, which will be running on a roughly fortnightly basis, every 2 weeks. Sometimes slightly more frequently, depending on when our speakers can make it. This is quite possibly the best moment we've had for a long time, so thank you for coming along. We will have to order more food if the numbers keep up like this, but I'm not complaining. We've got a fantastic speaker for our first seminar and a great paper. I'm delighted to introduce Professor Susan Watson, who's a professor in law at the University of Auckland. And Susan writes, teaches and consults in the areas of corporate law and corporate governance, and her particular areas of research are theories of the company, which she's speaking on today in part, and also directors' duties and liabilities. Susan's published widely in these areas, both locally and internationally. She's editor and chief contributor to a couple of highly prestigious texts, The Law of Business Organisations, and also Company and Securities Law in New Zealand, co-editor John Farrer. And before joining the university in a previous life, Susan was a solicitor and associate in two city law firms. And in a slightly later previous life, she was also based at the business school at the University of Auckland, where she's previously been head of department before moving to law school. So, without further ado, I will hand you over to Susan. And the topic of Susan's paper is something that will interest pretty much all of us, I think, the corporate legal person. Susan.
Thank you, and thank you, Mark, and thank you for this invitation. It's lovely to come here. I've been here for 3 months in sabbatical. I'm going back on Thursday, so I've been in a fortunate position coming from New Zealand with going for 3 summers this year. So going home, we hope, to the summer, and having enjoyed what's been a pretty good English summer after hearing in the past that, in fact, English weather's terrible. Well, actually, I don't think it's too bad. I just think you all make a big fuss about it. So thank you very much for having me. This is a wonderful opportunity to be able to speak to such a prestigious audience, and especially to be able to talk about my favourite topic, which is the company. And the ideas of the company and corporate legal personality. And I guess what got me interested in this topic is actually doing a lot of what I'm doing right now, which is standing in front of groups of people, most particularly more students, perhaps undergraduate students. And for all of you who have studied company law, probably in the first class you hear about, when you hear about Salomon and Salomon, you also hear that the company is a separate legal entity, and you also hear that the company is a legal person. And so after teaching that, and I've probably taught company law for about 25 years, which horrifies me to say, after you teach that for a few years, you sort of think, well, I hope no one actually really asks what that means when you talk about separate legal entity, or when you talk about the company being a legal person, and particularly that they don't ask, well, where did that come from? Other questions you hope students don't ask after a while is, you talk about, we generally talk about the company being an association or an aggregate of shareholders, and then we'd say that the company is a separate legal entity from those shareholders. And you wait for a student to say, well, hang on, which one is it? Because actually, when you think about it, those two statements are, on the face of them anyway, inconsistent. So it's those sorts of questions. And also another question that you wonder is when you talk about the corporate legal person, if someone would say, well, how can a company be a legal person? And if it is a legal person, well, what's that company made up of? And how does it get the status of being a legal person? Is it a legal person because the state says it's a legal person? Or does it derive its legal personality in some way from the people who are part of it, if in fact they are? So those are all the sorts of questions that I guess you hope, teaching company law, you hope that students don't ask, but then after a while, perhaps you ask them yourself and think, well, I'm trying to get to the bottom of this. And having embarked upon that journey, and lucky I'm on sabbatical, which is academics lucky enough to have 6 months on sabbatical to be able to spend enough time to have a look at this question, even at a kind of preliminary level, which is, this paper is a working paper, it's not a final version, because what you quickly realise is it's a really complex question, and you really have to go, if you're going to look at it through a historical lens, really need to go back quite a long way to try and kind of draw together the threads to say, well, actually, what happened to get us to the position where we are now? And even the position where we are now around the corporate legal person, around separate legal entity, as probably everyone in this room knows, remains very contested. And that's amazing when you think, well, here we've got this form which is one of the foundations of capitalism, and we don't really have anywhere near consensus on what exactly a company is. Are people in it? Are they outside it? Does a company derive its status from the state, or does it derive its status as a legal person somehow from the people who are involved in and around it? So those central questions, I think most people would agree, aren't settled in corporate law, even though companies are so important. So those are the kinds of themes of the paper, and this is very much ideas, particularly the second part of the paper that I'm playing around with. So going back in the history, and it's lucky I had a reasonable period of time to do it, because it ended up needing to dip right back into history as far back as the Romans, and looking at the forms that the Romans had, which really probably are the origins, at least in an indirect way, of the forms that we have today. And so really the Romans, as you'll see if you've looked at the paper, really had two forms, and they had two forms that were used for business, or not just for business, but were used to some extent for business. One was the universitas, and the other was the societas. So the universitas unquestionably was a collective of people who were given a form of legal status by the Romans, or by the state, or the equivalent then. And the societas was sort of an atomistic form which was formed by a contract, or the equivalents of contract in that time, and it was the people who were part of it who formed the societas. So the universitas, in fact, a well-known writer who writes about the history of companies said that it was the origin of the idea of the judicial person, or juridical person. But in fact, it wasn't. In fact, although there's not complete agreement on this, mostly people accept that really it wasn't a legal person, because the Romans didn't conceive of anything that wasn't a human being that had the status of a legal person. But really the universitas was a rights and duties bearing entity that was given some form of status. So it wasn't, they didn't have the idea of a legal person, it was just something that was sort of parasitic on the people who were involved in it. So then you sort of jump forward into the Middle Ages, and kind of where the idea of perhaps this idea of legal fiction, or the legal entity, separate legal entity, first started to emerge. And that's probably with Innocent IV, who was the Pope. But before that was actually quite a well-known jurist. And so it was Innocent IV who first conceived, and again, it's sort of arguable, but you can draw it from what he wrote, this idea that you could have a legal person that existed separately, or existed separately from the people who were part of it. And in this case, of course, it was monks. He's talking about the universitas, but he's talking about the legal person existing separately from the monks. So Innocent IV, in several statements he made, he said that actually a universitas couldn't be excommunicated, even though the monks who were part of it could be. Various other statements he made showed that he believed that it was possible for this entity to exist at law separately from the people who were part of it. So it's sort of the beginning of an idea of separate legal entity. But very kind of, you know, you kind of search for it, and it could be interpreted generally many ways, but most people say, well, okay, that's perhaps where this legal fiction idea started. But probably the clear, well, of course, there's no question when you look at Sutton's case, as one of the foundation cases of corporations law from 1612. And in Sutton's case, there's no question that Lord Cook, in Sutton's case, did talk about the company as a metaphysical legal fiction, as something that existed at law as a person, separate from the people who were part of it, and that it wasn't essential for there to be a corporation, that it had a physical form. And the context of the case was quite interesting, in fact, actually, that when you look at them, we'd find amazing today, in the sense that Lord Cook, who was, of course, the famous judge, was also one of the corporators of the company that the action was brought against, but he was still able to act in the case, so he had these incredible conflicts of interest. And also, it was a situation where the heirs of Sutton, who was a very rich man, one of the richest men of Elizabethan times, was seeking to leave money to this charitable corporation, and his heirs were challenging that bequest. So that was the context. So Cook, of course, was very motivated in many ways to fight against the heirs, as he did, and in favour of the corporation being a valid corporation. So the argument that was run by the heirs was essentially that at the time the corporation was formed, there were no buildings, there were no people, so there was nothing that you could say the corporation was. So that was the context in which Cook could say, well, yes, it existed at law. And he also said, which was the beginning of concession theory, because he said that incorporation is a concession of the state. So you become a corporation, you gain your status from the state or the crown at that time, not from the people combining. So very much, a public, nowadays we think of a public law idea of a corporation. Now you jump forward, and again this jumps around in history to try and sort of see where everything came from. And you jump forward 200 years, and you have a fellow writing a book who was in the Tower of London. I can't remember his name at the moment, but he wrote the book in the Tower of London. It was the first book on corporations, and he talked about corporations being bulky and visible, made up of the people who comprised them, being an aggregate of those people, and then sort of consigned in quite a kind of slightly derogatory way what Lord Cook had said, and he said that way we might set aside the metaphysics of the past. So this guy was a kid, his name was Kidd, was writing in a very different way about the corporation's form to the way in which Cook wrote about them 200 years earlier. So the question then is, well, clearly the idea of what a corporation was had changed during that period. So at the time of Kidd, writing in the 18th century, corporation was clearly, he believed, comprised of the people and sort of founded upon them and almost parasitic on them, whereas at the time of Cook, it existed separately from them. So what had happened in the 200 years that you had these completely different views of the corporation? And of course, what had happened was that you had the joint stock company, which had emerged. So when Cook wrote Sutton, his report for Sutton in 1612, although there were forms of joint stock company, in England at least, they didn't yet have double entry bookkeeping. So you didn't have for accounting purposes, you didn't have a separation of the corporate fund from the incorporators or from the shareholders or stockholders. And it wasn't actually until later in the 17th century that double entry bookkeeping came into England, and with it the joint stock company. So for example, when Cook in 1612 was writing, the East India Company did exist, but it didn't have a separate joint stock fund. That wasn't separated until, I think, something like 1688, after, of course, Cook had gone. So what had happened is that in that interim period between when Kidd wrote his book in the 18th century and when Sutton, Lord Cook wrote Sutton in 1612, you had the joint stock company emerging as a type of corporation. So there were many other types of corporations, as everyone here will know in this room, ecclesiastical corporations, many other types. But a new form had emerged in the corporation's family or genus or species, if you like, and that was the corporation that had joint stock. And when you had the corporation that had joint stock, you had people who were combined in the corporation with the joint stock. So the people who held the joint stock were part of the joint stock company, and so therefore, if you like, what the corporation was included those people. So even though it might have been in some ways a separate legal entity, it wasn't a separate legal entity from its shareholders or from the incorporators, because they were part of it, and legally they were connected with the joint stock. So the joint stock was separated for accounting purposes at that time, but not for legal purposes. Now, so where did this idea of separate joint stock come from in a legal sense? Well, of course, we all know that by the time of Salomon, there was no question that the court said that, the courts confirmed in a sense, really, that a company was a separate legal entity from its shareholders. So you had legal separation of the joint stock from the shareholders in the company. The shareholders outside the company, arguably, I would argue, the joint stock in the company. But where did this idea of joint stock being legally separate from shareholders come from? Well, that came from the other form, which again, everyone in this room will be familiar with, being the deed of settlement form that was created by contract. And at the same time you had the joint stock companies that were corporations that Kidd was writing about, you had a parallel form that had been developed really by clever lawyers and by entrepreneurs, and it only was developed to get around the Bubble Act of 1720, which made it almost impossible to get corporate charters. So what the deed of settlement company did is it used the new emerging private law forms of wouldn't use the contract, but it also used the trust. And what happened is that the incorporators formed a partnership and settled assets on, or settled a fund on the trust. And so, and the Chancery Courts, it was an equitable company, so the Chancery Courts recognised that it was a form of company, even though it wasn't recognised at common law. So you had a type, for the first time with the deed of settlement companies that existed prior to the general incorporation statutes of the mid-19th century, you had a form of company where you had legal and accounting separation of the joint stock fund. And also within, and they sat within the trust. So you had all these existing forms, and another form which I'll talk about in a minute, the statutory corporation, that existed at the time of the general incorporation statutes. So the general incorporation statutes come in the middle of the 19th century, the first Companies Act being in 1844. And then the question is, well, what are these modern companies? So these modern companies are incorporated by following a process in a statute. So what have you got when you look at previous forms? Where do they sit? Of course, there's lots of pre-existing forms that you could say they were a continuation of. So one argument, and a very good book that I'd recommend to you called, I think, Trust and Corporation by C.A. Cook. Well, he argues that really they were a descendant of the equitable company form, the form that was created by deed of settlement. And in the first Companies Act, you had in 1844, really, William Gladstone wanted to bring all those types of deed of settlement companies in under the umbrella of the state, if you like. So they were forced to register through a two-stage process. So the existing deed of settlement companies had to pre-register, and then after 2 years, if they made it through, they were allowed to sort of have a full form of corporation. At the same time, you had, as the deed of settlement companies, so that was the equitable idea, but that was 1844. But by 1856, which is 10 years later, you had, with the 1856 Act and the 1862 Act, which was really the foundations of all our modern companies act, you had a very different idea coming in about what corporations were and what they were for. So whereas Gladstone wanted to control companies, Robert Lowe, who was the architect of the 1856 Act and the 1862 Act, essentially wanted to facilitate incorporation, encourage incorporation, wanted people to join their capital so that companies were formed. So a much more facilitative act, and it seems when you look at Lowe's statements that he very much regarded the modern company as really a continuation of the joint stock companies that had existed as corporations in the 18th century. So the sort of middle ground form that you could say was partly public because it came into existence by a charter, and partly private because it was people combining in joint stock. Well, it seemed to be what Robert Lowe thought was the form that was being authorised by the new modern Companies Acts. And then you had a third possibility about how you might regard these modern companies, and that was because there was another form that also existed prior to the general incorporation statutes, and that was the statutory corporations. And the statutory corporations were essentially companies, corporations that were formed. There was a special statute for each one, and they were for ventures like railroads, particularly railways, were very often formed by these separate statutes. But prior to that, the turnpike companies, the waterway companies, the canal companies. And they were statutory corporations, their own special statute. And the interesting thing about those companies was that the shareholders very often were given limited liability. So very not much is often said about statutory corporations, but they were a very early form of limited liability. And the other interesting thing about statutory corporations was that the cases on them, and a lot of these cases are cases that you're familiar, that are company law cases that came from corporations, these statutory corporations, like Foss and Harbottle and other cases, well, there they said that the company is a separate legal entity from its shareholders. So really, if they were statutory corporations, then you had separate legal entity, and also statutory corporations had limited liability. So what were the modern companies? Which one of these three antecedents would they kind of draw on for principles, and what would they become? Well, at the beginning, I think everyone agreed that they were the association of shareholders. So you had that equitable form dominating, or if not the intermediate form, the joint stock company that was a corporation. But as the century progressed, and I would argue perhaps is partly contributed to by limited liability, increasingly shareholders were separated in a legal sense from that joint stock fund. So remember, in the joint stock company of the 18th century, there was no question that they were combined with the joint stock fund in the company. But increasingly, as the century progressed with the development of the capital maintenance rules, with the importation of principles like ultra vires from statutory corporations law, well, increasingly, they were regarded as shareholders' status changed to increasingly being treated as investors outside the company rather than being in any way, if they ever had been, partners or associates within the company. And really that's what happened with Salomon at the end of the century, is you really had that final legal acknowledgement that legally, as well as for accounting purposes, shareholders were separate from the joint stock fund. So Salomon, in a sense, at least you could argue, or should have settled the question in the sense that the shareholders, the company was a separate legal entity from the shareholders. There were ideas of a separate legal entity or an entity that could exist without people in it, because we had Cook's Corporation, we also had the Deed of Settlement Trust form, where you had the fund separate legally from the people. So there were lots of kind of precedents and ideas that pre-existed that didn't make it such a conceptual leap. But so that should be the end of the story and the end of any questioning about what a company is. But of course, that wasn't what happened. What happened is that it was after Salomon that you had this sudden emergence of great legal writers like Maitland, translating Burke. You had all these theories about what a company is that really kind of took off after Salomon, the case that should have settled the question. Because the question remained, well, if we accept that a company is a separate legal entity, then what's inside it and what is outside it? And you had also from North America, you had the old idea of the aggregate idea of the company, which came from the Societas in Roman times, that a company was really an aggregate of people. That was revived, and Morawitz, who was one of the leading founders of that idea, sort of drew on ideas from the 18th century and from Deed of Settlement companies to say, well, actually, a corporation or a modern company is also an aggregate or a contractually based entity. So, in fact, the contractual ideas re-emerge, but from a different source. And that was really from the North Americans then also coming into English law. And you also had other ideas that, from Maitland's translation of Burke, that companies were really real entities, that they existed in the world, they had a physical form. So you had all these different ideas emerging. And the idea that seemed to die away and lose in all of this was the concession theory idea. And that was Cook's idea that incorporation was a concession of the state. And in fact, Maitland said that, and with it went legal fiction perhaps, because what Maitland said is that if concession has died, hopefully the idea of the company as a legal fiction has also died with it. So that's the position that we're left in, and this is the part, I guess it's a real focus of where I really appreciate feedback and comments from people who have read the paper or got ideas about this. I think it's possible to run an argument that even though concession theory died, and with it the idea that you gain your status as a legal person as a concession from the state, I think you have to accept that, because once you had an incorporation statute, you no longer had to ask the state for a charter. You sort of had incorporation as of right. But I think you can still argue that actually it's a condition, it's a sort of right so long as you follow a process set out in a statute. So you could actually argue that it's a different, perhaps not a concession, but it's a different, it still comes from the state. And in fact, that you can't be a corporate legal person without following that process in the statute. So if all of us got together in this room and said that we're going to form a company and we all signed a contract together and agreed that we were a company, well, we wouldn't be a company. You have to incorporate a company. And a company as a legal person doesn't exist, I would argue, and this is where I'm just the people, doesn't exist the instant, even though it's brought together by the participants or people creating it. It doesn't exist the second before it's incorporated, and exists for all purposes after that. And that's why perhaps courts are very extremely rare that they'll do this thing called lifting the corporate bail, because essentially you've followed a process in a statute. And even though it's not a concession, it's still a legal fiction. It's something that's a creation of the state. And you can't have a company without following that process in that statute. So really, although it's not the concession in the way that Cook was writing about it, it's still something which you can only gain by going through a process that is state-driven. So if you had to categorise the essential component of the company, if you accept that the essential component of the company is that it's a legal person and a separate legal entity, well, certainly separate legal entity has evolved through the case law, but the status of being a legal person can only be something that comes from being permitted to become a legal person by the state. And when you look at the history of the company, that's probably the strongest thread, the thread that comes down through corporations law. So I write about that in a bit more detail in the paper, and also talk about how you can, and the other part of it is how you look at the, what is the company then if it's not the people? And this idea that the company is a fund or an entity that has a persona. So Margaret Blair's written about the idea that companies have personas, like their brand, how they're perceived by other people, and the fact that that persona, that external aspect of the company, does actually impact on everyone's life. So even though the company, the corporation that Cook was writing about sort of was a metaphysical idea, the modern corporation certainly does have a type of form, even though it doesn't contain people, but it's a type of form that's a persona interacts with people and which people interact with if they're workers who work for the company, if they're consumers that buy things from the company. And of course the modern company, which Cook's corporation didn't contain, also contains that fund. And even though we don't have the capital maintenance rules anymore, there is a kind of, if you like, core to the company that is the initial share capital. So those two things combined, the core, that's the fund and everything the company owns, intellectual property, and these days increasingly important with the technology companies is what a company owns and controls. Well, that core and that persona are affected by the human beings that interact with the company, but also the company does affect the lives of those human beings, even though it's a legal fiction, even though it's something that doesn't contain people. And when you look at other legal, and there's a quote in the paper, that in fact legal fictions, even though they exist just at law, they can have real effects on the people in the world and people's lives, and being other legal fictions, if you think about it, being things like money. So I just want to finish up at that point, and if anyone's got any questions or particularly comments, ideas,